Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today we're covering Season 3, Episode 2, Rick Mansing the Stone. Here's Aaron with the recap.
Beth and Jerry are getting a divorce, and the family has various ways of coping with it. Beth checks out just a little as a parent, content with simulations of her kids and lots of wine. Summer engages in thrill-seeking and self-destructive behavior. Morty befriends a sentient left arm on a quest to avenge his family, and the wind whispers "loser" to Jerry.
All right, Aaron, what'd you think of second episode of season 3?
I think this is a great episode. It's entertaining. I bust a gut every single time the wind whispers "loser" to Jerry. Mm-hmm. I think there's something very primally funny about nature itself rejecting the Jerry organism. You know, in various ways, like in creatures great and small, and there's just something to that and his dress and garb that I find very, very satisfying. And I really like that Summer continues to be more integrated into the main adventuring group.
Mm-hmm.
I like Rick's patronizing her, like, "Oh, Sum, come, you know, grandpa's concern for your safety is fleeting." And then him doing the same thing when he's like, as he's packing up to leave, as the manufactured crisis has occurred, he's like, "Oh, Sum, I can't believe it would end so soon." I think it's great. What do you think?
Yeah, and Summer calling him on that stuff too. It's real good.
Yeah.
I am not a product of divorce, though I know many people out there are. I was looking at this sort of through the lens of my life, trying to find the parallels, and I think I found them a little bit in like being disowned by your family for religious reasons. I think that's the feelings around that are comparable in some ways. And so I was trying to approach it from that angle, but I really like what they do here with, you know, showing the different reactions of the kids, showing the reaction of Beth to, the new status of their family.
Yeah.
And how, you know, by the end of this episode, I feel like they have worked through a large portion of that.
Mm.
And granted, it's only 23 minutes and it's a short amount of time to go through, but they live 3 weeks or more in this world and have, you know, experiences that sort of shape how they feel about their families.
Mm-hmm.
In this crazy situation they're in.
Yeah, I like they do some smart things where in the start of the episode, you'd think that like Morty is the most functional of them because he's like talking about, "Hey, isn't this something that we need to worry about? And I'm worried about my sister and I'm worried about my..." But like by the end of the episode, you realize that he's, you know, just being self-aware to the struggle does not make it less of one.
Yeah.
And his using Armathy as a crutch, which, you know, again, the concept of Armathy is great. What a fully realized character in about, you know, like two charade games and a 15-second flashback, POV of a left arm flashback. they fully create this character.
They do, and it's no wonder that Morty bonds with it, right? They're kind of going through similar things. Like,
sure.
Armathy has lost
destruction of the family.
Yeah. And Morty feels as if he's lost his too. And so, yeah, the fact that like Morty is sort of in denial about it, right? And then through the course of the adventure that his arm takes him on, he understands, "Oh, actually, no, I'm sort of angry about this and I want to lash out, but why?" And like,
yeah,
it's a good arc for him.
There is an interesting like anger. I'm not going to say misdirected or misplaced anger towards Jerry as the dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder where that's coming from, because it seems like maybe Jerry is taking his like passive aggressive approach to life into the divorce, because it seems like instead of like coming up with something that the kids would want to do to hang out with him, he just wants to guilt trip them into not being excited about, or not. I don't know what he expected from the final goodbye, because it's like,
yeah.
We're going to see you. Like, aren't we coming over to your apartment on Thursday night? Or it's not like you're leaving and you're never coming back. It's, you know, it's the same thing that like they had with the Look Who's Purging, where, you know, Jerry's just pestering Summer for money. Now he's pestering the kids, I guess, for affection.
Yeah, and he's confused as to why his dad won't fight for this relationship that he views as so vital to the family.
Yeah.
And that dynamic. And by the end, I think, you know, he's come to terms with it, which is maybe where I identify with it most. It's like, how much does Morty's happiness depend on his father's happiness? Right. Like, or that very specific, relationship that they had before.
Yeah.
Well, Morty at the end decides it doesn't depend very much on that. Right. Like he's got his life to live. And if he's not willing to fight for something, maybe he just doesn't care. Maybe it's not valuable to him.
Well,
right?
That's the other thing is like, that's why I'm like, it's something about this passive aggressive thing, because it's, didn't Morty say something about like, you know, fight for your relationship or don't.
Uh-huh.
And let it go. Like it's essentially shit or get off the pot.
Right.
The thing, the course of action where you're just kind of making sure everyone knows how bummed out you are about this deal that you're going through is not attractive to anyone.
And I think it follows on from everything we've seen from Jerry, right? Like Beth has, you know, the speech earlier in like, I can't remember if it was first season or second season, but she's talking about how she's sort of working to make this relationship work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that Morty hits on, that the Jerry is not, right? Jerry is just being Jerry, and it doesn't seem like the relationship shows any value. And yet every time it's threatened, he tries to like puff up and pretend like it matters to him.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really.
Right.
Otherwise he would be fighting for it, like Morty says. So like, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, the only thing he hates more than being left is the hassle of like fighting for the relationship, you know? It's just this
right.
Everything happens to Jerry. He's never like a captain of his own ship.
And he can't admit that to himself.
Right.
He can't admit that this doesn't mean as much to him as wearing this stupid fucking hat from Titanic or whatever. Like,
yeah, and then I feel like Morty's self-aware enough to realize, like, God damn, this is my dad. I don't want to be like that. Like, what? Like at some point you realize, I don't know, maybe this is just specific to me, but like, rebelling against your parents is essentially saying, like, rebelling against all the negative things in your parents' life. Because it's like, you know, I'm unbridled potential, and look at you, to the extent that your parents are lame and pathetic, and they probably are because they're so much older than you and you're much younger and vital. Like, I don't want to become your sad, broken thing. So, like, you do things differently, and that's how it works. And I feel like that Morty, he's already aware that he's kind of, like, the wind, if not whispering, is starting to think of him as a loser.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, he's wanting to shake that stink off of him, so he takes it out on his dad. It seems like both of the kids, though, are squarely blaming everything on Jerry. Does it? You feel like that's a good reading situation?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that statement.
I don't know that it's fair.
I agree with that one as well.
But I also understand why it's happening.
And I agree with that one as well, yeah.
All right.
I think we're in agreement here.
Podcast audience, are we all on the same page? Okay, we can move on to the next topic.
Absolutely. Like, I don't know that Jerry putting his foot down here and giving an ultimatum may be a stupid decision in that moment, because it does sort of lead to the breakup of his family.
Right.
But also, he's 100% correct in his assessment of Rick, and Rick admits as much in the end of the previous episode.
Sure.
Like, I did all this because Jerry crossed me and I wanted to fuck him up as bad as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the collateral damage here is the family.
Right.
Jerry recognizes that Rick is the problem here, and or that their sort of tolerance, their over-tolerance of all of Rick's shenanigans is the problem. And yet the kids don't see Jerry's being correct here. What they see is Jerry putting his foot down and that being the root cause of the family blowing up.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like what all the aspects of being unfair, because, you know, I guess the way he put his foot down is like he's laying in a Normandy and he's at the back of the boat pissing himself, saying, oh my God, there's machine guns at the front. And then there's guys that are like, you know, running through that machine gun fire and they're getting killed too. And it's like, well, they're both dead, but the guy that ran forward, we kind of like better because, you know, he's at least trying to do something, where the guy in the back's is saying machine gun fire bad. You know, like this whole Rick thing bad is like, you know, but what's the workable solution? What's the compromise? How do you lead Beth and the family to that same conclusion? Or, you know, maybe if that's the thing, if they're going to go down with that Rick ship, then maybe you should be okay with that and build a new attractive home for your children to be feel safe and sheltered and not threatened by aliens in, you know? Again, yeah, shoot or get off the pot, man.
And I think Summer's reaction is also equally interesting to Morty, because she seems to be rebelling in a different way. It's more like she wants to go build a life without her family, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? This is such a clusterfuck that I'm going to take the world by the reins, and I'm just going to be my own person here and not even want to go back to my family, right? I want to stay here forever.
Well, there's also like this like thrill seeking kind of semi suicidal aspect to it too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like you know, I might die, but I'm also it's going to be surrounded by fire and explosions and maybe the man, the mustache helmet wearing man that I love.
And completely on my own terms.
Yeah, it's like this is a lot like, you know, you watch those videos of like Russian teenagers getting drunk and hanging off of 700 foot antennas like by their pinkies or some shit. It's just like, fuck it, you know, like Summer is in just kind of fuck it mode, and it leads her someplace really savage but true. There's something really interesting, I think, about the fact that Summer has kind of lives her best life in this kind of savage environment with no rules or restrictions, in the same way that like Beth and Jerry and her thrive in the Cronenberg world as a nuclear unit.
I'm trying to determine, are they saying something about technology and its effects on relationships and specifically the familial unit?
I don't know. It reminds me of this book I read a couple years back called Sapiens, where this guy talks about like early human development, and he essentially argues that most of like what we do as a pastime tries to recreate the dopamine rush of like hunting a mammoth. You know, like what you are living life. Like,
are you telling me when I'm playing Monster
with your
Hunter
brothers
World?
And sisters and aunts and uncles chase this thing down and savagely kill it, and you dress in its skin and you dance around a fire and you eat it, and like who the fuck is bored? Maybe someone got gored this time. It's like your pulse is racing. Like that's a fucking life fully lived, and now we jump out of airplanes because we're just trying to do anything to make us feel. Like that you don't need a meaning in life when life is so fucking struggle, like at like that existential level.
So Summer is creating her own meaning here by going back to this sort of savage existence.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
If you can't find meaning in your family and then the world that you're so accustomed to, outside it.
Maybe we shouldn't be afraid of the apocalypse, Jim. It's just the,
I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
Like I'll die immediately.
Yeah.
But you know, that's...
I mean, it sucks we hunted the mammoths to the extinction, so they're not around. I mean, like...
Yeah, there's
taking down a feral Jersey cow, I don't think is going to provide the same amount of excitement.
No.
You just have to approach it with a bouquet of flowers and conk it on the head. Yeah, I guess you can run around in his skin if you want to, but...
Yeah, it's weird because, they go back to the savage existence and the technology isn't there. And when Rick gives the technology, the electricity to this society, that blows up Summer and hemorrhages relationship, right? Because all Hemorrhage wants to do is sit around and watch
it un-Cronenbergs their world, and now it's safe and sane.
Yeah, and then you can see sort of on the other hand this weird like technology bringing the Smith family together a little bit, like. Mm. Rick creates these human analog robots for Rick and Summer, or for Morty and Summer, rather. And by the end of the episode, they're playing games together. They're having a good, healthy dynamic, and Beth is really into it.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not sure what they're trying to say about tech here as it relates to the family, but it seems like they're going for something.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, the other thing is that's a healthy family dynamic in a very leave it to beaver kind of way. We're having wholesome fun at the family table. Meanwhile, Beth has literally an entire glass of wine in her goblet. Like it's not,
and these aren't even Summer and
that's what I'm
Morty.
Saying. She's taking
poor
the
facsimiles.
Yeah. She's taking the cipher from the Matrix deal of hey, ignorance is bliss. Drunken ignorance is even better. It's even more blissful. But if she was on her A game, like she so desperately wants to believe that this divorce is the correct decision and it's going to make her and her family healthier that she's willing to take these absurd caricatures of her family.
Right. One that's screaming out as it dies.
Yeah.
She pays it no attention because of her desperation. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the other thing is like, how does she contextualize what happens at the end of this episode?
Oh,
where
it's so good.
You got this existential fight that this robot's putting up, and then they come back in and they're all dressed in their
Summer has
wasteland
a face tattoo.
Clothes. Yeah, yeah.
No, it's insane, but I love it
because there's a little bit of like, you know, I think this is kind of true to like children of divorce. Because I wasn't a child of one, but I'm a parent of a divorced child, and it seems like there's a little bit of. Well, if dad didn't like Grandpa Rick, we're going to Grandpa Rick it all the time. Like, Jerry'd be afraid of a flaming car coming out of a portal and smashing some deformed little person. But who cares, you know? And if Jerry like is asking questions, I'm going to double down on that. Who cares? Because, you know, fuck him and his whole worldview. Like it's. She's really like, yeah, I get it. You love Rick and you trust him with his kids, your kids, as opposed to Jerry. But holy hell, like, she's really writing those blank checks with her children's safety to Rick in this episode.
Yeah, and I think like it's the more the parents are able to hide the discontent, in that relationship, and the more they're able to like preserve a veneer of a happy family for the child. The harder it probably is during a divorce,
yeah,
because it feels like they're taking away something good, right? Not something that's caused them so much strife and problem. Like it's almost like if the parents are arguing all the time, like that could be maybe a partial relief. I'm sure it's complicated, but like, taking away a Leave It to Beaver style family dynamic with a kid is probably pretty rough.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember, you know, like I didn't have the happiest childhood. Like my parents didn't get divorced, but whoo boy, maybe they should have. And I remember going to sleep hearing my parents screaming at each other. Like I did kind of hang my hat on the fact like, well, you know, at least we are a family. You know, we're all living in the same house and we have dinner and, you know, shit, my friend Timmy only sees his dad every other week. And it's like. Yeah, maybe that, like, even if everybody's kind of, like, on board with this is the way things had to go, there's still a lot of fear. I mean,
it's just change.
Yeah, especially change that the kids have no control over.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like it's going to happen regardless.
I want to talk about some of the characters in this, because this episode, you know, does deal with heavy subjects like divorce and how that affects children. It also is just a lot of fun. Like, this Beyond Thunderdome kind of Mad Max world that they construct here is amazing. Down to, like, the character designs. I'm always fascinated by how the animators come up with this shit. Like, you've got the ruler of the Death Stalkers in the beginning is this guy named Colossus, and he's got this jaw and teeth contraption connected to tubes. It doesn't connect to his head, and, like, I'm just fascinated how that works. And then, you know, you get some weird characters, like some of the people Morty fights in the Blood Dome are like, one guy's got suspenders that connect to his nipple rings to hold them up. And I'm like, yeah, if you're going for a BDSM look, I guess this is the way
to go. That's a liability going into a pit fight, though.
I would think so. Yeah. Any kind of dangling jewelry, especially connected to your clothing.
Convert those to regular suspenders when you go, and maybe take out the nipple jewelry before. That's just what I would do.
I would. I mean, some people might get off on that. Not me.
Yeah. Like, I think I would, if I was going through a brisk hike through some underbrush, I would take out my nipple rings, let alone the Blood Dome.
Or put on a shirt.
Yeah.
You could do that, too.
I mean, the funny thing is a lot of these designs were, like, directly lifted from the Mad Max series. Like, I think the first guy is kind of based on Immortan Joe, and Hemorrhage is based on whoever the assless chap guy was.
Lord Humongous, yeah.
Yes, yes, from the Road Warrior. Mm-hmm. And then Summer's outfit is straight up Tina Fey. Yeah.
Tina Turner. Tina Fey, yes.
Tina Fey could absolutely rock that. but I think I've seen more Mad Max than you. Certainly, because you've not seen the new one,
I haven't seen Fury Road, and I haven't seen Beyond Thunderdome.
Because I feel like a lot of the riffing was like 60% of the references were from Fury Road alone.
Okay.
And there's also like, I just love the making fun of like the pigeon English.
Mm-hmm.
That the other thing that's really funny is like, this is the apocalypse, but they make it clear that when you go into the mutants of old Seattle, they're wearing like Bart Simpson t-shirts, and there's like Atari logo. Like, this didn't happen 150 years ago. This happened like in the last generation, and they can't say word nuclear explosion. It's got to be the boomy booms and the before four times. They play with a lot of this post-apocalyptic kind of, like, in Mad Max, it's all guzzoline, right? It's like, oh, pick up bullets at the bullet farm and get the guzzoline from the priest of, you know, the pedal. It's super fun, but I'd like to hurl, Jesus Christ, did all the boomy booms destroy your wordy word books?
And then Summer ends up with a face tattoo. I'm kind of wondering what happens to that in future episodes. I kind of feel like they should keep it.
It would
be funny.
Keep
it around and just have that as Summer's look now.
She's just rocking to Mike Tyson.
And it'd be a good way to sort of distinguish, you know, in a multi-dimensional thing, which Summer is which. If you wanted to play around with that, you could. Like,
yeah, yeah.
A lot of reasons to keep that face tattoo around.
I like how they also have fun with their villains. Like this guy who's the head of the medieval world that's holding everybody down has got... you know, his dialogue when we meet him, it's like he's in a bath with these two little boys.
My God.
And it's like it's like this pastiche of making the villains the worst of the worst. Like, this guy's obviously some kind of child molester, but the dialogue where he's like, grace my genitals again, taint washer, and you'll be shipped to the wasteland. As for you, genital washer, that's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And in a way that, like, further discussion would just make it moot. But I love the fact that, like, they do all those tropey things, but they also have fun of, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's a monster, but he's got his genital washing preferences. And
yeah, I'm trying to think if that's, like, that's definitely the funnier scene to me, especially, you know, once Armathy starts murdering that guy and Rick shows up and all that stuff, it turns really good. But early on in the episode, before the adventure gets started, there's a really good line from Summer where she's talking about not really knowing what carpe diem means. And she says, I'm too busy carping all them diems. Yeah. And Rick gives her like a sly high five. It's funny. I love that line.
It might actually work. It's like, I'm out there seizing all those
days. Yeah.
I mean, it works as well as it is. Is that would ever work, I suppose. But it's good stuff. And also the, like, how, especially on the back of last episode where Morty reveals that he was a True Blue grandson and, you know, he's trying to protect Summer. I feel like there is a full-fledged, there was like an unspoken rivalry, mm-hmm. but now it's like fully fledged. Like, Summer is trying, you know, with the divorce juice flowing through her, she's consciously trying to take over the mantle of chief adventurer.
Yeah, absolutely. They're reacting to adventures in polar opposite ways. Like, Morty always seems very reluctant to actually go on these.
Yeah.
Summer's all gung-ho.
Yeah.
I wonder if that will change after her coming to terms with this divorce.
Yeah, I'm wondering that. I'm also, like, I am very curious to see, like, if they ever mix. Because we've seen how Jerry mixes in these adventures, and we'll see a little bit more this season to come. But, like, I kind of want to see... like, what's Beth's whole deal with one of these type of deals?
Because,
mm-hmm. like I said, we'll find out more about her this season as well.
Yeah, if she wants to reengage with the family, just get in on the adventures, because the rest of the family's having adventures.
Yeah, yeah. Even fucking Jerry's getting in on this whole adventure game.
Not anymore, though, I don't think. I think Rick's done. Rick's done with Jerry.
He's exiled. He's exiled from the family.
One last thing that I noticed in the episode is where Hemorrhage takes his helmet off. And he gives this whole monologue. It's very, like, half insecure, half, like, maybe too sympathetic sort of monologue about, you know, sort of judging, like, not wanting to be judged for his own appearance, but then finding himself judging other people for their appearance, which is this vicious cycle that mm-hmm. just sort of leads back in on itself. I don't know that I have a lot to say other than to point out that this is all just, you know, a riff on vanity. But I found it compelling and funny.
I mean, I feel it's also the idea that I feel like stereotypically people say like teenage girls are obsessed with their appearance, like teenage boys don't care. And I find that that's not my experience as a teenage boy, nor was my experience with other, like, everybody wanted to look good and everybody wanted to shine. It's just like, you're an awkward teenager. And because that's the thing, is like this hemorrhage, you expect him to be like some 45-year-old dude, but in reality, he's like a 16, 17-year-old boy that's just as insecure and awkward as Summer is. You know, as I think we pointed out the fact that Summer is literally just Jerry with a ponytail.
Yep.
And if you think about that in real life terms, that's probably not a super great look for her. That, you know, she has to compensate with like super cute tops. And, you know, he's got this like awkward haircut and mustache. And to me, it felt very like, this is a 17-year-old trying to figure out what's going to look good on picture day kind of thing.
And did you try growing a mustache?
Yes. I tried to grow a mustache before my mustache was ready to grow, and it's tragic. Something I'm trying to. My son's 13, and he's starting to get the wisp of one, and I broke out my old middle school photos. Like, is this what you want? Is this what you want?
Yeah.
Wear this bucket, son. Hide it from the world.
Setting a good
example.
Learn
how to use a razor.
By showing him a bad example.
Yeah. Yeah. This is what happens when your parents don't care enough to tell you, to sit you down and say, this is not a good look.
Does this look cool to you?
Yeah. No. It's very hard to pull off a mustache, period, nowadays.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's like reserved for firefighters and cops.
No. I feel like the hipsters brought it back a bit. Like, you can.
A little bit.
If you want to get like brown shoes and a fucking tropical pattern shirt, or better yet, pineapple pattern shirt, you can pull off a mustache. The culture will allow it now.
Yeah. I think you're, I mean, David Harbour's bringing it back.
Yeah, that's true.
We're rocking a mustache, and
I feel like it all started with Ron Swanson.
I was going to say.
He started the trend back toward the mustache.
Yeah, said like you can have a pompadour and a 50s mustache and no one's going to accuse you of being a pervert. If you look like Ron Swanson.
Fair.
After the break, Aaron Couch of the Hollywood Reporter's Heat Vision blog joins us to discuss divorced dads and to try and predict some Rick and Morty future. We'll be right back.
If you don't have the flu, then don't bother listening. The flu snot is glistening all around us. I'm a flu-hating rapper.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Aaron Couch is the editor of The Hollywood Reporter's Heat Vision blog, which covers all things comic books and science fiction and pop culture. You can follow him on Twitter at Aaron Couch. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
We kind of start these conversations the same way that we always do, and that is we want to get at what your relationship with Rick and or Morty is.
Yeah, so I basically had been hearing about it for a long time. I did not start watching it until after season two was out. So, you know, season three was kind of my first real time one that I got to enjoy. But it was my brother-in-law came and showed me the Meeseeks episode, and it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. You know, he's like, this is the one that'll get you into it. And he was right. And then I got married and season three was coming out, and we kind of binged that during our honeymoon a little bit. And so, you know, I kind of have special memories for season three as well, which is kind of funny.
You picked a good one.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, it's my favorite ongoing comedy right now for sure.
What is it about the Meeseeks episode, man? Like, I was kind of bullied into watching it by several friends of mine. And I remember thinking the first few episodes were, okay, I kind of see. But Meeseeks is the one where I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of see. What is it about Meeseeks?
Yeah, I think that it's, you're just thrown into it. And it's, these guys just want to die. I mean, it's just so weird. It kind of makes sense in context of the show, but at the time, I don't know. I guess it's just so creative and out there that if you're going to like the show, you're going to, you know right away, this is for me or it's not for me, right, on that episode.
It's such a great, it's almost like a Sunday, a parfait experience, because you've got like this pitch perfect satire of the, like, your failures are your own old man speech that we've seen from so many different science fiction fantasy shows. But they also, it's like, we've never seen it done by some guy huffing helium and, you know, and these self-replicating blue monsters. There's something there. I wish I could figure, because I feel like that episode has the entire Rick and Morty formula in its DNA.
Yeah, one of the things I think makes it work so well is kind of one of those formulaic things where they kind of just establish this very weird premise, right? Mm. And then they just follow it. Like, where is this premise going to take us? Not like trying to write from some agenda.
Yeah.
With the Meeseeks, it's always, they kind of establish the rule. These things want to die. They're here to accomplish a very specific task, and they will go to any length to do it.
Yeah.
And they just follow that, and it leads you to this golf game, which is truly insane by the end of the episode.
Right. And the fact that, like, it's the Jerry thing too, because like only Jerry would set such a modest goal and become bored, you know, or frustrated with its achievability within an afternoon, dooming them to their fate. It's something there.
I think you nailed it. Yeah, the Jerry. That's what it is. Yeah,
right. It's all that stuff. Then you just add Jerry and watch what ensues. We brought you on here to talk about Rick Mansing the Stone. This is the, of course, the Mad Rick Fury Road episode. What you think of Rick Mansing the Stone?
It was really touching because I, you know, in my memory, oh, it's the Mad Max episode, but it was touching to see, oh my gosh, I had forgotten that the kids going through the divorce and acting out, that is, now that I've, you know, I watched it a few times to prepare for this, that's the thing that really sticks out for me. So yeah, I love it when the show gets surprisingly touching, and it's just so weird the way it handles that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, this is definitely a standout for me. How about you guys?
I remember being kind of somewhat shocked because we had a lot of time to come to grips with like the first episode because the way it was, you know, released for an April Fool's joke and there's many, many months. But, you know, the will they won't they with the divorce of you know, Jerry and Beth, I was kind of surprised that the second episode, the very next episode, they established that they were going to get divorced. That it was like, boom, that you're here and you're dealing with it. And I guess because my parents, they got divorced, but they had the courtesy to wait until I was a full grown adult to do it. I imagine that's how it probably feels as a child. Like the first time you really think about it, like mom and dad are sitting there talking about it and dad's moving out.
Yeah. I mean, basically that was it for me for sure. You know, I was a kid and it's kind of, I could kind of relate to this one for sure.
So that's interesting. Cause I, you know, not to be too delicate, I was wondering, you know, what, cause I know Jim and I hadn't had that experience as kids. There's a lot of like really subtle details, like, Jerry's wardrobe. That, like, you know, like Jerry's very established Jerry identity, but now he's got a members only jacket and his Titanic hat because, you know, he's trying
to figure out where he went wrong in life, right? How did I get here?
Yeah, it's like, well, these are things I like, so I'm trying something new out. That must be a weird experience to see, like, this known quantity, your father, and now he's going to reinvent himself, do something with turquoise out in Arizona. The other thing I thought was cool, but felt real, is the fact that, like, Jerry is not going to turn around and become some kind of awesome, actualized Jerry. In fact, you know, getting dumped probably is just going to make whatever insecurity and stuff that kind of fuels his Jerry engine even worse. It's going to be turbo fueled with whatever shame and guilt and insecurity he's got. And that's, you know, it's such a brilliant like visualization of that, the wind whispering loser. I thought that's it's just like, it's such a Jerry thing that the universe now is conspiring to like you use that Jerry shame engine to get sustenance from. And I like that. I don't know what it means.
And then literally,
like,
if you're a wolf,
yeah, if you're
like,
literally,
I love that tag where he, you know, he feeds his unemployment check to this voracious wolf.
But that's the thing, the wolf doesn't even want it.
No, it spits it back out.
Yeah, it's like I thought this was what I wanted, but it's too pathetic. It's great.
I love that you mentioned the clothes, because that was what was cracking me up. I just have this memory of, you know, one day my dad started wearing like a beret or something like that, you know, just like, huh, okay, that, you know, but it is what you're saying, where it's kind of easy to almost make fun of, but you know, it's a person trying to move on and reinvent themselves, as you say. And as a kid, it is kind of strange, but yeah, I definitely related to you know, Jerry's hat and stuff. And yeah, it's just so perfect. It was perfect.
The beret, huh? That's exciting.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. It was a red beret. I think that lasted about a year. So, I mean, he was doing his own thing. At the time it was, I feel like at the time, you know, I think he had the beret, he may have grown a mustache, you know, because you have to grow facial hair too after something like that usually. I don't think Jerry does, right? But
yeah.
But yeah, that's also kind of the sign, yeah. Yeah, I didn't really have, I don't think that kind of anger or anything like that, you know, there's no Armathy feelings, but certainly the kind of the confusion I can relate to.
Well, it's so interesting because, like, you know, you have so many kids that have, like, you know, it's, of course, again, I can't relate to it directly, but I've seen it, you know, in my own friends. I've seen it certainly portrayed in Hollywood productions and television adaptations, where kids do have these complicated feelings of, you know, aggression and grief and sorrow. And there's no, like, you know, there's no clear, just outlet for those feelings. And to have, like, this Rick and Morty situation where you're in a completely different dimension and the morality's different, and now you're gifted with this murderous, invincible arm to kind of, like, as an unhealthy coping mechanism. I mean, that's, like, Morty's breaking into... What do you do if you're a middle class kid and you're wanting to cut loose? You break into like a rich person's house under construction. You spray paint over all their mirrors. You scratch up all their linoleum tubs. You do something like that.
You've seen some very specific movies.
Yeah, you skateboard in their empty swimming pools. You do that. But if you're Morty, you go to a Purge planet or a Mad Max planet, and you just kill and maim until all the pain goes away.
Right.
Or if you're Summer, you act out in different ways, right? Like that's one of the things I appreciated is sort of the different ways that the kids react to the divorce of their parents. You know, Morty almost does it on a subconscious level until it becomes very conscious, mm-hmm. With this arm that sort of takes over his body, and he doesn't understand, you know, why is it killing? What is happening here? And he's just along for the ride until he's not. Summer very much makes a choice to rebel in other ways, right? Like she goes off and starts to she has this idea that nothing matters, it's all bullshit, which I think is like she comes to maybe a healthier understanding at the end when she goes to see Jerry. But yeah, she's very much dealing with things in her own way, and I liked both of those perspectives.
Yeah, also like I think there's something about you finding like everybody when they leave their parents, especially if it wasn't a completely rosy, like perfect family thing. It's like, oh, I'm, you know, when I get a relationship, I'm going to do things opposite. Or if I have kids, I'm going to do things opposite. Mm. But mostly, you know, we're creatures of pattern habit. And if we have patterns and habits kind of laid in front of us to follow, we do that. And I thought they did a lot of interesting playing with that where like Summer and Hemorrhage. That their relationship was kind of an inversion of Beth and Jerry's, where like in the first season they're so hapless, but then when the Cronenberg universe happens, they find some measure of peace and happiness and like a workable family, right? And like that's what Summer and Hemorrhage have, and then when that turns into a stable kind of like everyday routine, they start Beth and Jerrying. I thought that was pretty funny. And prescient.
Yeah, I hadn't made the connection between the Cronenberg version. That's a great point. I love that.
Yeah, like they have to have some kind of daily struggle, or that dissatisfaction and insecurity turns inward and they just start destroying each other.
Yeah, I mean, with Mad Max, I don't know about you guys. I mean, Fury Road is the one I've seen a lot of times. I've seen the others, I think, once each, so I didn't really get as many of the non Fury Road references, but there were still plenty that, you know, even just through pop culture, just osmosis, you know, everybody knows the Thunderdome and things like that. So yeah, how did that stuff speak to you guys? Did you get a lot of those references?
Jim might be the anti Aaron because I think he's not seen Fury Road, but he's seen all the others.
So I haven't seen all the others. I saw the first. I saw the second. I don't think I've seen Thunderdome.
Oh, you haven't seen
ever
Beyond Thunderdome? Okay.
No, but I do recognize. You know, it's pretty obvious they have a character in there who's supposed to be like a Tina Turner kind of character. It's some of the references, like you mentioned, Aaron. It's just through osmosis you pick them up in culture. That's kind of where I'm approaching this episode from.
I think Summer's like stainless steel dress combination was what Tina Turner was wearing in Thunderdome too. Like like the chainmail dress with the exaggerated shoulder pads.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the whole having the shrieking guy like announcing the fights, that stuff is all super, super funny. I do like the arc of the Armathy, how efficiently they tell that story. It's essentially two charade conversations and a five second flashback, and that's everything you need to know and understand about Armathy and his whole deal.
Yeah, an arm has a flashback. I mean, another way this show, you know, kind of is able to top itself. Who has an arm flashback scene? I mean, that's
right.
So good.
It's like the
and
point
it's from
of view
the POV of the arm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's from the POV of Armathy, but since we don't know him, it's just his just giant left arm prominently out there doing all this ass kicking and stuff.
The idea that this evil, you know, Braveheart, Conan the Barbarian kind of villain would recognize the arm.
Right.
Is hilarious to me.
Yeah, there's something about that arm. That was super funny. I love, speaking of the charade stuff, is like where, you know, the arm gives an ambiguous answer about whether it's over or not, and they have this like 30 second scene of Morty trying to figure out, he's like, just make a fist if it's not over, and he makes a fist, it's not over. I fucking love that comedy torture stuff too, and it works so well in the like an episode that's completely, I mean, this is one of the lesser hinged episodes, you know, because you've got, it's just a Mad Max world that you're mm-hmm. that you're reacting to. There's, it's not like a slightly skewed version of Earth. It's just a full on apocalypse.
Did we want to talk about the sort? I think this is the introduction of any kind of robotic human analog kind of beings. And I found even the short, like the brief stuff that they do with Morty in those scenes kind of compelling. He goes through, it's very similar to where in the pilot you see them running through, you know, the interdimensional customs, and this being pops out into existence and dies in the span of like 3 seconds. I felt that same feeling going through the scenes with Robot Morty, where he's coming to seemingly some form of sentience, and then Rick pulls the plug on him, right?
Mm-hmm.
it was dark and weirdly comical. But this is kind of the first time I think they've dealt with that sort of issue. And it's something that I would like to see more of. Do you have any thoughts on that as, you know, a general sci-fi geek?
Yeah, I think that the monologue he says, you know, I'm alive, and then, you know, hello, that has to be probably top five moments of all time for me for this show. I mean, I would love to see what would happen had that robot gotten to live. I mean, would he be kind of an enlightened being? I mean, he seems like he really was a very sweet robot, right? So mm-hmm. yeah, that's definitely something I would love to see more of, is Rick actually giving these creations a chance to do something. Of course, that's very anti-Rick. I mean, he's not going to care, right? On the one hand, I don't see why not just let this guy live. On the other, I guess it's just going to be annoying to him. Is that kind of the case?
That sounds about right. Yeah, if it's annoying to him, he kills it. Or if it challenges him in any way.
I was going to say, I mean, I've seen two seasons of Westworld. I don't think just letting the robots evolve and do their own thing, even if they're sweet and innocent, it doesn't seem like it goes very well for either robot nor human.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he knows that. Yeah. But yeah, and you know, and we have to give a shout out to quote mode in quote mode. That thing just had so many golden lines. Yeah, it was great.
And Beth not realizing that, she just assumes it's the way millennials are talking nowadays, a quote mode.
Mm-hmm.
What aspect of like Beth and Jerry's relationship is performative? Let me explain. Like, there is, at the very beginning of the episode, the kids are kind of like, you know, ambivalently saying goodbye to their dad. You know, he's about to, you know, pack up and leave. But what does that even mean? Because they're still like, we'll probably see you next week, whatever. And when Beth comes out the garage, he's like, well, if you want to know, the kids are with grandpa in the portal. And she's like, yeah, whatever, and walks out. Does she really care that little about what the kids are doing with the grandparents? Does Jerry really care that much? Like, I don't, because like Beth, it seems like maybe she's drinking a lot of wine and she really doesn't understand how checked out her kids are. It's one of those things I was wondering about their relationship. Like, maybe Jerry cares more about the kids a little bit.
Yeah, I love that you use the word performative, because I hadn't really thought about that with Beth, but it does actually seem like, you know, some of her, you know, open annoyance or disdain for Jerry. Yeah, it probably is a little performative. Yeah, in terms of the kids, I mean, as you hit on, the fact that she was so happy with these three robots, you know, and didn't even notice it, what, you know, the robots were, you know, she was ignorant about it, but it made her happy. And I love the idea that, you know, in the future, maybe the robots will rule us, but we'll all be happy and just not even care and not even notice. And yeah, that seems kind of like the path that Beth fell into for this one, right?
Hey, if the Matrix can steal my body heat and run the world without me noticing, I say,
yeah,
more power to that Matrix.
That's honestly probably the best scenario we could hope for from Robot Overlords.
Keep that perfectly cooked steak coming, and I'm not going to ask any questions, all right?
Yeah, sounds great.
One thing I wanted to ask you, Aaron, is that, you know, your position here as the heat vision blogger, as the science fiction, fantasy, kind of pop culture, comic book guy, that beat that you hold down, you know, Rick and Morty is this engine that it runs on, you know, grinding through those kind of pop culture tropes, whether it's Back to the Future, whether it's Battlestar. I was wondering, like, as you kind of look out in 2019 and the pop culture kind of landscape, what are the big things you see that Rick and Morty haven't touched on, or maybe they touched on and has been lightly? What's the big thing in season four that's coming down the pike, do you think, that they can lift and blow us all away?
Yeah, you know, as the Rick and Morty experts, I actually had a couple, and I was curious if you could help me, because I may be wrong here, but is it a rule that time travel is not ever going to happen in Rick and Morty? Have they said that before?
To the extent that anything is a rule on Rick and Morty, it does seem like the writer's room is duly cautious about manipulating time, because, boy... You know, they've all watched the movies and the television shows where that goes wrong, right?
It's pretty ironic for the name of the show, I would say.
Yeah. Okay, so time travel is out. And what about, you know, something that I want to see more of just in general that I'm interested in is kind of, you know, AI, but not just, you know, Westworld where they're smart robots. But I love the idea of some kind of all-knowing, you know, an AI the size of a planet or something like that. How much AI have they done on the show? We kind of touched on it with, you know, these robots in this episode, but I'm kind of forgetting if we've seen something like that.
No, I mean, you've seen like super intelligences, like the collective, like what, Unity? There's certainly been the scientist inside the microverse, the Stephen Colbert character is like an intellect approaching him, but you've got like the only smart AI I can think of is Rick's car, you know, keeping Summer safe. Yeah.
It would be interesting to see more of that, because every time, like I mentioned before, if Rick is challenged in any way, he fights back, right? To kind of preserve the life that he wants to live. As the universe's most intelligent being, I think AI would be a big challenge to him.
Yeah, especially if it was, you know, because Rick's car, I don't know if it's really conscious or, you know, something conscious that there is really self-aware, because I think, you know, Rick's car is clearly firmly in his control and kind of operates by, you know, a certain set of rules. But yeah, something that is self-learning and getting bigger and bigger would be, I would love to see that.
You said, the size of a planet. Like if you had essentially a Unity-esque artificial intelligence that had more resources than Rick, potentially, I think there's a lot of drama to be squeezed out.
Wouldn't it be amazing if like Rick has to abandon his car in deep space at some point? He builds another one, and no one even thinks of. But like three seasons later, it comes back like V'ger in the first Star Trek, and it's gained sentience. It's the size of a planet, and now. I don't know. It'd be really funny if it's like somehow it's trying to keep Summer safe, and it's trying to sterilize all life out of galaxy except for Summer or something. I like that, because like something that Rick himself designed, like an artificial intelligence that he himself designed, is a threat to him, because that's what keeps Elon Musk up at night, right? The fact that someone's going to write that Tesla is going to be so good at driving that it eventually takes over the world or something. I think that's what it is. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, there's like this famous example where like somebody creates an AI to calculate pi, and it takes over the world, and like eventually the galaxy just getting more and more decimals of pi correct, just creating a giant computer, because like, that's what it was supposed to do. You know, so I love that. That kind of fits the car thing. Yeah, keep Summer safe. That's a great idea.
Giant robots versus giant, like, you know, like a Pacific Rick. I think that would be useful. Giant robots are always fun. I actually just saw one this weekend. Mortal Engines, that like Peter Jackson produced thing about giant predator cities eating smaller cities. I watched it. I watched it. It's long Memorial Day week or long Labor Day weekend. Come at me. I don't give a fuck. I watched Mortal Engines. Okay, I think Mortal Engines would be a fun, because it's almost like they didn't give it any real thought. It's just like, hey, cities have wheels and they chase down smaller cities and eat them. That's our movie.
Right.
Like it didn't carry a 2-hour runtime. It might carry a 12-minute A plot or B plot. Yeah, I could see it.
I think you've hit on it. Yeah. 12 minutes versus, I like that you kept downgrading it from 23 minutes to 12 minutes. Yeah. I think that's about right. Cause I also saw it, and it did 2 hours is not quite work. Yeah.
And the episode title, Morty Engines. You already got the Rickification of it out the door. It
writes itself. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on the show with us, Aaron. Where do people find you if they would like to do that?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, guys. I'm on Twitter at Aaron Couch. And then all our Heat Vision stuff, the geek stuff at The Hollywood Reporter, it's at thr.com/heatvision. So, yeah, thanks again, guys. This has been great.
Yeah, our pleasure. We'll link all that stuff in the show notes. And thanks for coming on, Aaron. We'll catch you later.
Human music. I like it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
It is now time for us to plot to the future, Jim, where we open up a portal to Dimension BM-77 to access behind-the-scenes details, trivia, spoilers for future
I consent.
Episodes. All right, come with me through. There's not a ton. I don't know if it's because the commentary was not as insightful, or they were not drunk enough or too drunk. Or I was lazy taking notes, but the one thing I got from that, they originally had this device called the Bookalyzer, which was a device to allow to scan and people enter the fictional narrative of a book. Somehow that turned into this big whole deal, and what they really wanted to do apparently is tell this kind of medieval story with Armathy, and they're like, you know what, fuck it, we can just have a Mad Max dimension, and the castle can be in Mad Max, because anything can live in a Mad Max universe. Like steampunk,
yeah,
straight up feudalism, whatever. And they went with it.
I'm just shocked they couldn't make Bookalyzer work, because it seems like such a ripe concept. And it would fit right in with Rick and Morty. I wonder how much time they spent.
Well, the other thing is, I wonder if like it's one of those things, because half the time, as I've been listening to the commentaries, they talk about these ideas that they had to abandon or skew to get into. I wonder if like those are still in their back pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know what? We got 75% of a fucked up Eiffel Tower built.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like that it's fucked up. Let's go back and deconstruct it and see if we can get it to 100%. So I wonder, yeah, that'd be a great device to use. Although what do you do? It's like, it's a holodeck episode of Star Trek, right? Rick and Morty.
I mean, isn't every episode of this though? Like traveling through a portal is no different than traveling into a book.
That's what I'm saying. It's almost like the book is like it's the hat on the hat of like if you can you're already in a world that allows you to do anything you want. You know, the holodeck served the purpose in Star Trek to allow Patrick Stewart to put on tights and recite Shakespeare every two or three seasons as per his contract. And Rick and Morty, like fucking, they want to do Moby Dick. They can just go to Moby Dick Planet.
Yeah.
Where the it's an ocean world and populated entirely by vengeful whales, vengeful white whales.
Yeah, I think if I were the writer of the show, my tendency would be to try to figure out how distinguish it from the portal device.
Mm.
Don't know if it's possible. Haven't thought about it long enough, but
guest starred Joel McHale.
Yep,
of so many things, a fan.
Had to record a line on his phone apparently to send it in.
Thank God his head was in a bucket because you can't even tell.
Otherwise, you would have had a missing punchline to a joke.
How do you feel about that punchline? Because I felt like what Dan was saying about it being maybe a little overwritten. Because like the summer making the observation that like what's happened, your wordy words got blown up in the boomy booms. Like him coming back, do you mean a dictionary? I felt like the punch, like just let Summer spike the ball in his stupid face. You know, like what?
Yeah, maybe
the joke of a dictionary. What did that work for you? Because like, what is the joke?
I mean,
there?
The joke there is the reversal, right? Like,
yeah,
the joke there is the surprise of they don't have words for these things, but they very much have a real word for this other thing.
Is it so why are
and they're
doing...
aware of the concepts of dictionaries, and somehow yet they're unable to harness the power of a dictionary to preserve their language, like
for 15 years that they've had to make a grip on it.
Yeah, so I kind of like the joke. I think it adds another layer to it, and I guess it does risk overwriting it, but I enjoyed it. I liked it.
I guess, yeah, because I could see, like, it's not that they've gotten stupider. Not that they've gotten more stupid, rather. it's just that, like, maybe it's such a painful topic that they have these euphemisms. Like, if they actually talk about the world being incinerated in nuclear explosions, it's too much. But it's the boomy booms that happened in the before four time.
It's a coping mechanism?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Like I think people, you know, the death of like 90% of the world's population would be an event.
I mean, it's just like the blood dome is a coping mechanism, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something to keep their mind off the horrific nature,
right?
Or channel their anger and frustration into
a little bit of the ultraviolence to pass the time. Because what else are you gonna do? Did you see? I did not know this until I started researching, but apparently it's canon. That the Smith family lives in the suburbs of Seattle.
Yeah, I guess Justin has said that in interviews.
He said on a Twitter status back in 2016, I'm going to include this in the show notes, that he said it was in Seattle, and that was obviously several years before this season. And then this season, they, you know, the fact, I guess it didn't immediately register to me that they would have to be approximate to the place in their neighborhood, that they've essentially displaced dimensionally, but not, this is not an alternate planet. This is very much Earth.
Yeah.
So they've just jumped to some lateral dimension, the exact same time, the exact same physical place. So they're close enough to just bounce over to Seattle for some hunting and then come right back.
Yeah. Makes
sense. I
don't
think there's anything. I will say that like, it doesn't seem like there's nearly enough rain.
It's true.
Like there's a lot of sunshine in the neighborhood, and it's my understanding that there's only like 3 or 4 weeks of that per year in Seattle. Everything else is kind of drizzly.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, there's also like a desert. But to me, like that's just apocalypse, man. It didn't used to be a desert. It's what the boomy booms did civic engineering.
I don't think they're too worried about any of that stuff. I think like, you know, saying they live in Seattle is a nice nod to kind of where Justin would place the house if he had to, but like, I don't think they consider that. Oh, where are we at? You know, how rainy should it be in this scene based on their location?
We also, there's They had a little bit of discussion and commentary about the lengths that Rick will go to avoid being like honest about his intentions, his feelings, that the what happened to him in the wedding squanchers like so scarred him that he would literally rather eat human flesh before. Well, there's a compromise. He chewed it, but he did not swallow. It's like the Bill Clinton. He smoked but did not inhaled, or he puffed it but not inhaled. He'd rather do that than actually tell Morty like what his real plans and designs are for this, because, you know, look what happens if you start trusting people. I thought that was pretty interesting.
And then I guess like the one little Easter egg that'll come up later is in Rest and Relaxation later this season, the isotope is going to show back up.
Yeah.
I guess it's one of the devices used in that scene.
What a dickbag to like, you've got the 20 pound ball of the substance, but you got to come back for the
oh,
the
does
golf
he
ball.
See? I thought what happened there is he had broken up the larger chunk to disperse it throughout, because this is just in their fucking garage.
I mean,
right?
he was struggling to get a sizable chunk in that suitcase. It might not have been the entire chunk, but it was a good chunk of the chunk.
So he just wanted like that extra 2%
more. Like maybe at 18 pounds, he wanted that too. He was gonna leave him with 10% of their own fucking unobtainium.
Great.
Yeah. So then the hemorrhages roar. There's a lot of like funny. So I like the idea, you know, in the conversation we had about the episode proper, about the sapien stuff, like, what happens when you don't have mammoths to hunt is people start policing your recycling bins, which I actually agree. You know, I think you should put the shit right for the recycling to work.
Sure.
But also, like, I also feel like coming home after being harried all day and having your neighbor, like, you think, oh, it's going to be some, oh, we're going to have a good old-fashioned neighbor conversation, and they're just hassling about the recycling.
I mean, it's a sign of boredom, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have enough to do if you're watching me put my recycling out.
Yeah, yeah. That's the garbage man's job. That's the recycling man's job.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns, and myself, Ben Aaron, from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media at Bald Move. See you next time.